Bluegrass Jam Along is proud to be sponsored by Collings Guitars and Mandolins, each and every one built from the sound up in Austin, Texas. This episode is also brought to you by Peghead Nation, the home of roots music instruction. If you want to improve your playing, join me and thousands of other pickers getting better every day at pegheadnation.com. Hi, this is Matt, and you're listening to Bluegrass Jam Along, the podcast for anyone and everyone who loves bluegrass. Hey everybody, welcome back. This week's interview is with Bill Amatnik. Bill was the bass player in the David Grossman Quintet when their first record came out in 1977. He's played alongside Tony Rice. He knew Tony Rice. He officiated at Tony's wedding to Leela in the 80s. And most importantly, in terms of this conversation, he's written a book called Discovering Tony Rice that collects together a bunch of his memories of Tony, along with conversations with Jerry Douglas, Baylor Fleck, people related to Tony like Ron Rice, Frank Poindexter. And it's a warm, funny, interesting, celebratory, kind of inquisitive book. And the conversation mirrors that. We chat for an hour about the book, about Tony, about Bill's recollections. And as anybody who's listened to this podcast for a while knows, I've talked about Tony a lot on this podcast. And this next hour you're going to hear is testament to the fact that a lot is nowhere near enough to talk about Tony Rice. There's still more to learn. There's still more to think about, more to celebrate. And this conversation you're about to hear was an absolute joy. There's all sorts in here. I mean, you know, it was just a treat to get to do this. And I would urge you to go and buy Bill's book and read it for yourself. I will stick a link in the show notes so you can go and do that. But I'm not going to sort of labour the point of what's in here any more than that. Just have a listen. I really hope you enjoy it. Here comes my interview with Bill Amatnik. My guest on Bluegrass Jam Along this week is Bill Amatnik, who's written a fantastic book called Discovering Tony Rice. Bill played with Tony in the David Grossman Quintet, spent time with Tony, but has also spent time talking to friends and family about Tony for this book, and I'm really looking forward to talking about it. Bill, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much. And before we begin, Matt, many congratulations on your IBMA Momentum Award. That's just wonderful.
Oh, thanks so much. It was a treat to get to go, but to actually win was something else.
Of course.
And it's I think it's one of the wonderful things about doing something like this podcast is getting to talk to a lot of people about their experiences of music, and it's one of the fascinating things about a book like this, because it's not just a memoir of your memories of Tony. It's not just a book about Tony. It collects together how a lot of people felt and a lot of people's different perceptions. And I'd love to just start with sort of what brought you to write the book in the first place, if that's okay.
Well, Tony died in late December of 2020. And somewhere in the first quarter of 2021, I sat down to write a 1,000 or 2,000 word article about what I learned from Tony. And then I started thinking about, well, what did Tony learn from other people? And then I started calling around, and pretty soon I had many more words than 2,000. And I thought, oh, I've got the basis for a book here, so I'll keep going. And I decided on the core group of people to call, and one thing led to another, and finally I've got a 260-page book.
It's great. There's a really interesting mix of people in there. There's, you know, Tony's family, including Ron Rice and Frank Poindexter, but, you know, some of the, when you think of people that Tony's played with, you know, Baylor Flex in there, Mark Schatz, Peter Rowan, Sam Bush, Jerry Douglas, you know, Larry Sparks as well, and it's a fascinating mix. And also, obviously, you knew Tony pretty well yourself, not just through playing with him in the David Grossman Quintet, but also you officiated at Tony's wedding to Leela in 1980, I believe.
Yes, I did. Peter Rowan said that Tony told him that Leela was the love of his life. And when they broke up a few years later, it hit him very, very, very hard and put him into a bit of a funk for quite a few years, I believe. So anyway, it was an honor that he asked me to marry him to Leela. It was on, I think, November 2nd of 1980.
And I think what I find fascinating about this book is that at one point you talk about the kind of the process, but also some of the reasons for writing it. I'm just going to read you a bit that I found particularly interesting. It says, Tony and I played music together for uncounted hours in the DGQ, drove hundreds of miles shoulder to shoulder in a Mercury station wagon, toke bud, broke bread and swilled coffee together, shared laugh stories and dressing rooms many times. I thought I knew him, but I didn't. I began discovering Tony Rice as I started listening to these stories about him, and hope you do as well. And that's, you know, I think that's one of the things that becomes clear whenever people talk about Tony, is that sense that nobody, or many, many people, felt like they didn't really know him. And so the outpouring of affection and stories, and people seemed to be really keen to talk about Tony because people felt like maybe they didn't know him and would like to have known him better.
I think you're right. Everyone I approached to interview readily agreed. And everyone I spoke with seemed more than delighted to talk about the guy and what they knew and what they felt about him and what they didn't know about him. I don't know if anyone knew him all, but I think together, all these main eight people that I interviewed, together I think we get a fairly good, broad picture of Tony. They all miss him. They all loved him, and they all grieve for him. And every one of them felt that playing music with Tony was a treasured experience, and certainly I feel the same way.
And there must be a sort of a way of knowing somebody through music where there are bits of them that you can know that aren't expressed by words, maybe, or a certain connection and a certain bond when you spend time in a rehearsal room with somebody that you do know them in a way that maybe they're not able to express to you in words.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that when you play music with someone, you create a bond. You know them on a certain level that you could never know them otherwise. You've felt deeply with them. You've created art with them, created expression with them. It's a way of knowing someone that, again, in person, it's just not matched. They're almost two different worlds, how deeply you can know and love someone through playing music, perhaps more deep and certainly differently than knowing them in person.
Yeah, and be interested to know when you first met Tony, because you were the bass player on that first David Grossman Quintet record in, I think, 1977. Had you known Tony long by that point?
I had never known him, but certainly I knew about him through reading about him in Bluegrass Unlimited, which may have been a mimeographed publication at that point. But I certainly remember reading about him and all the superlatives that were written about him. So when the opportunity came to actually play with him the first time at a rehearsal at Grisman's house, it was really something I looked forward to and a deeply treasured experience.
I'm reading your recollections of that in the book. There's a definite, obviously, you know, this was David Grossman's band, but there's a definite sense that Tony was a musical leader in that band in many ways.
Well, let me put it this way, Matt. Certainly in the playing, in the music, in the execution of the music, he was the rhythmic force, which is not to diminish David's playing. David is a very strong player. It's very fun to play with David. He plays great time, great rhythm, plays great solos. But the heartbeat, with all due respect, came from Tony. Now, having said that, what were we doing? We were playing mostly David's tunes. So you cannot possibly diminish David's tunes. They were very unique, and the music we played, as I think it was Tony who coined the expression new acoustic music, and at the heart of the new acoustic music was David's tunes and Tony's sense of rhythm.
We'll be right back with you just after this. We'll be right back with you just after this. Collings Guitars has been a long-time supporter of the bluegrass community, from collaborating with artists to sponsoring festivals big and small. And now, by sponsoring Bluegrass Jamalong. Handmade in Austin, Texas, every Collings guitar and mandolin that leaves the shop is built from the sound up, and the team loves seeing a Collings in the hands of players of all levels, from local musicians to world-renowned pickers. Visit collingsguitars.com for more. This episode is also brought to you by Peghead Nation, the home of roots music instruction. With 65 streaming video courses for guitar, mandolin, banjo, fiddle, dobro, bass and ukulele from some of the leading names in acoustic music, Peghead Nation has something for every picker. You'll learn the tunes and techniques you need to join in at jams and play the music you love, plus advanced techniques like improvisation, theory and ear training. Your first course is just $20 per month and you can add more for $10 a month. Sign up for any course and get your first month free with the promo code JAMALONG, all one word. Join thousands of other players, including me, who are advancing on their instruments and having more fun playing the roots music they love at pegheadnation.com. And I've talked about Tony a lot on this podcast over the last couple of years with various people, and the one thing that everybody talks about is the rhythm playing, was Tony's rhythm playing. And when I first started talking to people, I thought they would be talking about the sort of incredible solos or maybe the singing, but Tony's rhythm guitar was the one thing that everybody sort of said, if I could keep one thing, that was the most astonishing thing about him.
Yes, and the earliest person whom I read writing about Tony's rhythm was J.D. Crowe. And he said that about Tony, that... I played with some great guitarists, but Tony's sense of rhythm, sense of time was just stupendous, and it was unique. Jerry Douglas said the same thing. He said, the first time I played with Tony, it was like being surrounded by guitar. Everywhere there was guitar. And Tony was not just playing boom chick, boom chick, boom chick, boom chick. Tony was all over the guitar and listening. It's easy to overlook this, but I think great playing begins with great ears. And Tony had beautiful, great big ears. He listened very closely and he accompanied you. He was not just playing what he wanted to play. He was playing what sounded best behind you as a soloist or behind the band. I remember the first time I played with him, we came to the end of the first tune and I was just jaw dropped, slack jawed. And I remember thinking, wow, Tony had rewritten bluegrass guitar. And yes, his rhythm was very memorable. Bela called it, with Tony playing behind you, it was like being on the magic carpet ride. So everyone had something to say about Tony's rhythm playing, which was very new, very unique, and very ear-filling.
Yeah, and that sense of that's definitely the other thing I get a sense of whenever I read about Tony or hear people talk about him, or that sense of he was an incredibly supportive and attentive musician. And the idea that, you know, there's a famous clip of somebody asking him to demonstrate his rhythm style, and he said, I can't really do it because there's nobody here to play with.
Oh, I never heard that. That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
And just that sense that the rhythm part doesn't exist unless there's a context for it. And that's, you know, that's, I remember when I first heard that, and it's like somebody kicks open a window in your brain and just shines a light on this thing that of course is true, but you know.
Well said, Matt. I agree with you 100%.
And sort of that is one of the things I find fascinating listening to that band is to people listening to sort of predominantly bluegrass music, it sounds, some of the Grisman stuff sounds very jazzy, and some of Tony's subsequent records sound very jazzy. But I would guess to a jazz player, they sound very much like string band music. And there's a space in there somewhere for the rhythm that could lean more towards being string band and could lean more towards being a kind of jazz delivery of that. And I think you said early on when you joined the band that you definitely felt that there was it needed a bluegrass sensibility rather than a jazz sensibility.
Absolutely. I heard them at the very first show they ever put on, which is, I think, January 31st in 76. They put on a show in Bolinas, California, where I lived at the time. And their bass player, Joe, may he rest in peace, was strongly a jazz bass player. I think he recorded with Moes Allison, among other people. And listening to him, I said, oh, I can do that. A few months later, I got the call to join a rehearsal. And again, my hat is off to Joe. He played great bass, but his bass playing was heavily rooted in jazz, and the group's feel with Tony at its rhythmic core had, I felt, its deepest roots in the acoustic string band sounds of bluegrass. I was so glad I got the call and auditioned, and so glad I got the gig. It was a great thrill to play with Tony and a great education, musical education, to play in the DGQ.
And that first quintet record, I was listening to it today, it sounds so kind of so astonishing listening to it all these years later. And it feels like a sort of springboard for the next 50 years of new acoustic music and sort of string band experimentation. And, you know, and I'd just be intrigued to know if the live shows were, like, did that record capture what that band was at the time, or was this like a whole swathe more of stuff at the live shows that's just a snapshot of?
Well, I think it did catch the group very well. And I think, again, my hat's off to David, who is an excellent producer. I think he produced his first album when he was 19 years old. However, and the album can be looked at as a concept album, which is to say, a piece of music that begins with the first tune and ends with the last, one long stroke, one concept. However, the live shows could be different. And the live shows, I saw people walk out of our live shows who clearly, Matt, had been transported. They were elevated. They were floating. Does one listen to the album and feel elevated and floating? Maybe so. I think the live shows could be, at our best, just a little bit phenomenal in that sense of transporting people. Did you ever see the DGQ live?
I didn't, no.
I see. Well, that's the sense I get, not only watching people as they left the venue, but speaking to them later on. How transportive a live DGQ show could be.
And sort of moving on into the kind of writing of the book, you were saying that you'd started calling around and started talking to people and realizing there was something more in this. Was there a sort of a format and approach that you had in mind at that point, or did it just sort of come together? Because that mix of sort of your memories and various other, and you make the point that different people remember some things differently or witnessed, you know, different people witnessed or heard stories from other people. And there is an element of mythology around Tony as well, potentially because he was such a secretive person in some ways. And I like that you acknowledge that in the book, and it's up there, it's, you know, front and center, that different people may remember these things differently. And I'm just sort of curious how this mix of your recollection and other people's came about.
Well, I certainly entered these interviews a little bit in the dark, not knowing what to say. I began most of my interviews with asking, how do you remember Tony Rice? And they kind of flowed from there. I was very gratified by the answers I got. I asked a question, did he speak much about his dad, Herb Rice? And the answers I got to that were just way all over the chart. I remember Flux said to me that he went on the road with Tony just a few days, or Tony went on the road with him just a few days after Tony's dad died, tragically in a home fire. And I just hadn't been expecting that. And just the variety of answers, it took me in directions that I had not expected at all, Matt. It was just all over the place, I'm very glad to say. These people knew Tony in ways that I hadn't. They knew Tony through eras that I had not. They knew a lot about Tony in many ways that I hadn't known, which is why I say that it wasn't until I started listening to these people speak that I started discovering Tony Rice. And boy, what a discovery it was.
And I love that as a title, you know, discovering Tony Rice, and the way you describe feeling like getting to know him through conducting these interviews. Was there a point where you were unsure as to how to approach having so many different answers to the same question? I mean, you know, it's a slightly contrived idea anyway, that a person is a single person and everybody's going to experience them in the same way. We're all we're all multiple people in different situations with different people. And, you know, that's just, life is a complicated thing and we are all multifaceted. But I wouldn't have wondered, as these interviews progressed and you found yourself with different answers to the same questions, if you felt the need to somehow reconcile those, or whether it was just made absolute sense just to present them as you heard them?
Well, it's a very good question. And it was easy to find stories that contradicted stories about the identical moment in time, or the identical backstage moment. And for a while, I said, I'd put a footnote in. Well, Bela said this about this moment, but so-and-so said something different. And then after a while, I abandoned that, although I think there are a few places in the book where I have a footnote that says, well, there are other stories that say Tony paid more or less for this guitar, and or so, you know. There, after a while, I abandoned that footnoting of stories that contradicted stories that were in the book. It's just the way it is. And as you pointed out, and I hope I pointed out in the book, yeah, people have different takes on the same thing. For instance, I went with Tony to pick up the Clarence White Martin in 79. And Tony is on record somewhere as saying it was an 81. But it wasn't. It was 79. I have it in my diary at the time, and Santa Cruz Guitar Company corroborates it. It doesn't mean that Tony was wrong. It just means that's his memory of it, and I accept it, and I came to accept all these stories that contradicted each other in various ways.
And it's interesting, isn't it, with so much of this stuff, that the fact is, like, we get hung up on facts and the truth, and actually the way people remember somebody and the way he made them feel is sort of the truth you want from something like this, rather than a list of dates and numbers and, you know, kind of, I think sometimes the facts can get in the way of what the real emotion is in a story.
I think you're absolutely right. I sometimes differentiate between fact, which is the absolute reality, and which is what journalists should be reporting to us, although I don't know they always do, and truth, which is the teller's way of looking at a situation. Tony's truth was that we went to pick up that Santa Cruz guitar in 81. And my truth is that we picked it up in 79. So I accept these truths. I agree with you that the truth is often much, much more meaningful than the fact. Although I believe I also have fact in the book, which is at very least a chapter devoted to the medical examiner's report on how Tony passed and the toxicology report as well. Those are facts, or I hope they're facts, absolute reality.
Yeah, and there's an interesting point, and that sort of maybe ties in. There's a place in the book where you say that to omit mention of Tony's life challenges and how he dealt with them, how they formed him and the musician he became, would be to diminish his stature as an artist deserving of having the truth told about him. And maybe that ties in with that as well, in that you have to look at all of it, and you have to, because everybody I've talked to about Tony has talked about the struggles that he had, and maybe this is the case with some musicians, is that the thing that you are so driven to express through your music is something that there isn't really another way for you to express. If you could express it in words, you wouldn't have that compulsion to communicate through music. And that conversation about the fact that Tony did have difficult times and how he dealt with them or didn't or got through them, and how that is part of the story, is also, I think, very meaningful and powerful as well.
I think so, and I agree. And what I want to underscore is what a hero he was, how strong he was, how triumphant he was in overcoming some of the difficulties and some of the hurdles of his life. I have a feeling that the last 10 years of his life were very difficult. He had pain so badly in his hands, he couldn't play the guitar. And yet he found something else to do, which was Accutron, a watch repair, and photography, things that he could do with his hands, in spite of the fact that his hands were diminished. So I want to take this moment to salute Tony for his strength, for his bravery in overcoming many issues, including the loss of his ability to flat pick. And what a huge, huge loss that must have been for him. I know his uncle Frank Poindexter said, well, this is what drove Tony's depression, and I wouldn't doubt it for a moment.
Yeah, and you can only imagine that if you are, and again, this is my sort of surmising of stuff, so I may be well off the mark here as well, but if you are driven to communicate through music because there's something that you can't express in any other way, and then that is taken from you, you know, it's, you can only imagine how hard that must be to deal with. And I think one of the things that I was most sort of moved by after Tony passed was seeing all the tributes on social media and in podcasts and people writing articles, and the immediate and overwhelming response was of sort of celebration of Tony and all that he had given. And at this point, I think there was a lot of sadness that meant there was definitely going to be no more music. But just the overwhelming kind of celebration of what he had given the world was, as somebody from outside of this music and somebody who was relatively new to it at that point, it felt like a really genuine and powerful thing of a community coming together around somebody that was universally loved.
I agree. There was sadness over our loss of him being gone, but there was also celebration for all that he had done. My gosh, he showed us a new way of playing bluegrass guitar, a new way of accompanying, a new way of comping, a new way of soloing. So I agree with you, Matt, on both scores. Yes, there was a lot of grieving that he's gone, but also a lot of celebration for all that he left. And he left behind so much music. He was an incredible musician and an extremely influential one, yes.
And when you started talking to people for the book, were there things that you obviously learned a lot about Tony along the way, but the things that really surprised you that came out of those interviews, and whether, I guess the second part of that is, were there any really common themes that emerged that surprised you, that sort of were threaded through all of those interviews?
Well, towards the end of the book, I try and say something. Let's see if I can find it quickly. There are a number of sides that many of the folks who picked with Tony touched on. They knew the whoosh of being swept into Tony's groove as he kicked off a tune, how it felt to play Time and Changes with him, his magic carpet, as Bela called it, under your feet. They all said Tony was a very funny guy, a crack-up, a blast to hang with. Peter Rowan called him one of the funniest guys he'd ever met. They all saw how very sharp he was, how very smart he was. They also all saw his sadness, knew that something was up, but could not always name it or its cause. And I've got to raise my hand here. I couldn't always name it or its cause. I saw that he was sometimes a sad person inside a shell, but I couldn't name it. His musician friends, I believe, understood the pressures he was under and the anxieties he suffered. Again, Flux said, hey, when you're up at this level of playing, there's pressure on you to be better today than you were yesterday, to be better in the recording you're making now than you were in the recording you made yesterday. And to be under that constant pressure is anxiety-producing. And I believe, and many of these people also saw, that Tony suffered anxiety. However, they all felt his love, expressed in many ways, and expressed at very least in his big hugs. But they also felt his distance. It was difficult to know Tony. To know someone means they've shared their innermost thoughts and feelings with you. And I don't think he opened up very often. He came over to my home one evening for dinner in Mill Valley sometime after his breakup with his wife, Leela. And boy, was he in the dumps. He brought in a blue cloud into the home with him. And I knew what was wrong. He even mentioned it once. But I could not get him to open up about what he was feeling about Leela and to share his thoughts and feelings and emotions about him. I just couldn't get him to go there. And by the way, this could be my failure, the inability to ask the right questions. And towards the end of his life, they all knew unanswered phone calls and texts and emails. Many of his friends witnessed Tony's refusal of help or his failure to ask for help. They said he allowed his decline to take place. Others said he was strong-willed. He was. And captained his winter's passage. He lived both his life and his life's decline in full control, they said. So those are the commonalities, if I may, that I heard in these eight people who spoke about Tony at length.
And it's really cool to hear about the humor, because I think one of the joys of having so much footage on YouTube these days is you could maybe read about Tony Rice and presume that sort of anxiety and darkness were a big bit. But you see some of the videos and you hear his interactions with the other musicians on the records when he's, you know, calling things out. And I think reading about somebody is one thing, but seeing somebody move and speak and interact and seeing videos of Tony laughing and smiling and, you know, I think that mix is, it's fascinating. And from my point of view, I put together nearly 5 hours of interviews last year to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Church Street Blues. And I started it off slightly naively, I think, presuming that I was going to talk to these people like Mike Marshall and Alison Krauss and Wyatt and Tim Stafford, and that they were the people who had all the answers. And I just realized that conducting these interviews, everybody else just had different questions. You know, everybody was, it was sort of joyous that it felt like people were prepared to talk to me about Tony because they wanted to learn something and they wanted to deepen their understanding as well through talking about it and hearing what everybody else had to say. And so there's something really beautiful about that, the overlapping of commonality and people's stories, but also some difference and the idea that there's still, like just reading your book, the idea of Tony sort of still emerging, you know, there is still a sort of, this might sound a bit trite and I don't mean it to, but that he is still an evolving, emerging presence amongst us through all the stuff he's done. And as new people listen to the music and get to know it and explore it, and there's so much more sort of still unfolding, if that makes sense.
I think it certainly does. And I think you're certainly right about watching him online. And boy, aren't we fortunate that there's so much of Tony's footage online on YouTube. I go back and listen to his performances at Merlefest, and I listen to them many times. I remember I once sent an email to Mark O'Connor, saying how great his solo was on, I forget whether it was a 9-pound hammer or one of those tunes. And about 6 months later, I wrote him again and said again what an astounding solo that was. And he wrote to me and he says, "Yeah, Bill, you already told me that." So, very, very fortunate, aren't we, that so much of his, especially his live concert footage, is there for us to watch. And besides listening to him, I think one of the things I learned is what an incredible band leader he was. I mean, here he is on stage with people who are all of them band leaders themselves, all of them master musicians. And yet when Tony was in charge of the band, they were following his direction. You know, with the flick of his eyes, he would indicate who was supposed to take the next solo. With a word of encouragement or another flick of his eyes, the guy would be egged on to take a second chorus in a row. So I think he was a magnificent band leader under not easy circumstances, which is to say leading people who are strong, strong players themselves. And, oh, yes, longtime band leaders themselves.
That's a really interesting point because people talk about Tony's lead playing and Tony's rhythm playing and obviously Tony's singing, which is some of the best sort of bluegrass singing on record. But that's the first time I've heard somebody talk about him as a band leader in that sense. And that I find that fascinating because he was obviously, just from what you hear and read about him, had such a clear sense of what he wanted. And the people use the word perfectionist, whether it's about the watches or the setup of his guitar or the way he played or the way he dressed or whatever. And to be that clear and be able to lead the band that way, and also to be, as you describe him, as such a sympathetic accompanist at the same time. Those two don't always go hand in hand.
Yes, yes, all those things. I agree very much. And you made a good point about his singing, you know. Tony was easily one of the top three bluegrass singers of his era. If I may just point out one other thing that he did. He spoke very little on stage. He did not like to speak. If he introduces a song, man, it's over in a sentence or two. And I feel that's a lesson he had to teach that many people still have to learn. We're not paying money to hear you stand up there and talk between tunes. We paid money to hear you play. And for whatever reason, Tony wanted to play. He didn't want to talk. And I think that was one of the reasons why Tony's concerts were really, really good, because all you got was music, 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 punctuated by very little speaking.
There's a point you make in the book at one stage about how meticulous he was with his tuning as well, that the time between songs was for making sure he was banging tune, and that he would always be sort of stepping to one side and just checking his guitar. And a few people have talked about that. About, I think Tim Stafford said that he thought one of, like, you know, amongst all the other things, one of Tony's most amazing abilities was to be able to tune an acoustic guitar as perfectly as he did.
Yes, it was kind of amazing. After every tune, and he played very hard, so after every tune, he probably put his guitar out of tune a little bit, and he'd turn away from the mic, and he'd tune very quickly. He had brilliant ears, and when he was done tuning, he would play the open guitar chords, E, A, D, G, and C. And man, they were equally in tune. And this is just not an easy feat to pull off, to get a guitar so in tune that all the first position guitar chords, including the D chord, which can be a problematic chord, that they were all equally in tune. It was just another aspect of him that was kind of amazing. I've never played with a guitarist who played so in tune and who could tune so quickly. And a part of his magic was in the use of a capo. Now, everyone uses the capo as a transposing tool, but Tony used it also as a tuning instrument. He would slap on the capo just south of the second fret, say, and he would tighten it up a little, jog it, tighten it, until all the notes had stopped buzzing. And then he would retune the one or two strings that needed a little help. And then he would go through the E, A, D, G, and C chords. And man, he would accomplish that in less time than it took me to talk about it.
And it's fascinating because, you know, as so many people learning to play guitar, I will get the guitar off the stand or out of the case and sort of get it in tune enough when they start playing without really, there must be a huge percentage of guitarists who never really play in tune that often. Like, it's imperfectly in tune, and it seems like such a simple thing. But I've heard people talk about it, and it's astonishing really to think about it in those terms. And that guitar, I've heard a couple of people say that it wasn't set up as a particularly easy guitar to play for other people. It was very much dialed into the way Tony wanted it, but it wasn't necessarily a traditional feel for a dreadnought.
Well, High Action plagued that guitar since the day the music store that bought it from Martin, Kenny Music, returned it to Martin for repair, saying the instrument had high action. And Martin, in its notes on the receipt of the guitar, acknowledged that it had high action. I don't know what they did. They reset the neck, I guess, and sent it back to Kenny. Who Kenny sold it to is unknown. And how it got out to the West Coast in the late 50s, where Clarence White picked it up and bought it, how it got out there is unknown. But High Action plagued this guitar, I think, all of its life. That Tony was able to play it, my hat's off to him again. Perhaps the High Action is what enabled him to play the instrument hard, so hard, to pick it so hard. If the action was lower, then we'd have heard the strings slapping on the frets and buzzing. And we really didn't. He could wham that guitar, as he said, flog it. He could flog it to its limits, and we would not hear the strings buzz. So perhaps the high action was part of what he needed in flogging the instrument so hard, and also what other people found about the instrument that was just not easy to play.
It's interesting, reading about how hard you describe him playing in the book, and that certainly explains, you know, the abundance of beautiful tone that he produced. But at the same time, the amount of control he had to be able to play a guitar that hard and have that, particularly the sort of the control over his pick and the very specific way that he played using his sort of thumb joint, and but power and precision are extraordinarily hard to balance and produce such a beautiful tone.
Yes, there's no question about it. They're contradictory. You know, the harder you play, potentially the less accurate you're going to be. But Tony played hard, and he played extremely accurately. His solos were really precipice daring. There was nothing safe about Tony's solos. He pressed his abilities to their very limit. He took solos that were daring. He played hard, and yet he played with great control and great command. He used a number of right-hand techniques, not only cross-picking, which vaguely is up, down, up, down, up, down, but sweeping the strings, which is maybe down, 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 up, or down, down, up, up. And he also sometimes, when the conditions were right and the audience was quiet, he would also finger-pick the strings with his middle and ring finger of his right hand. So, great power, great volume, and yet great accuracy, hard to stitch together. And Tony really did.
Yeah. And it's fascinating reading, you know, these accounts of, cause again, we can watch stuff, and, you know, there's all the wonderfully filmed homespun videos out there, but it's fascinating reading the sort of accounts of things from obviously you witnessed them very close up. And it makes total sense to me that people like me are astonished by Tony Rice, but it sort of constantly surprises me how much the musicians around him, who, you know, so many incredible level musicians, were also astounded by Tony Rice.
Yes. And isn't that a nice thing? Peter Rowan talked about when he played with Tony in the duo called Rowan and Rice. He recalled that when they played places that hadn't necessarily heard Tony play live, he pointed out the Settlers Festival in Texas, and people were out there in the audience sitting on bales. And Tony would come to the end of a solo, and people would audibly gasp, just astounded at his playing. So he astounded his audiences, and yes, he also astounded the people he played with. Although, to a certain extent, when you're playing with someone, you've got to keep command of your instrument and keep your emotions to a certain extent under control, so that you can execute what you want to execute. But there's no question about it that, you read that in everything that people had to say, that Tony was an amazement, and to play with him and have your ears filled with his exaltation of notes was a very gratifying and thrilling experience, and I cherish it to this day.
And you talked earlier about starting most of your conversations with the people you interviewed for the book by asking just a simple question: how do you remember Tony Rice? And if I was to ask you that, what would your answer be to how you remember Tony Rice?
Wow, funny. I asked that question of many people, but never of myself. How do I remember Tony Rice? I remember him very warmly. I remember him as a great musician, probably the greatest I ever played with, the most accomplished I ever played with. But I also remember him as a human being, one I traveled many, many miles with and played many gigs with and played many rehearsals with. And I remember his warmth. I remember him as a very sharp person. I remember him as someone who was extremely clever with language. He made up many band expressions and repeated them many times, many of these expressions. He said of the DGQ, he said, "These are the good old days." And that's very insightful to say that while you're living them. It's usually not till later that you remember back to a certain group or a certain concert or a certain time and go, "Oh, those were the good old days." So I think that was very insightful of him to say, "These are the good old days," because they were. So sharp, insightful, smart, funny, as all get out. He could be very warm and loving. And man, when you got a when he greeted you and you got a hug from Tony, it felt really, really good. So I remember him very warmly. I miss him very much. I hope people who read this book see it as a tribute to him. That's what I meant it to be. Thank you for asking that question, Matt. You made me contemplate something I had not before.
Thank you for sharing it. And thank you for, you know, on one hand, going out and having these conversations with people, but also just sharing your recollection of Tony, because I think, and back to that, the title, Discovering Tony Rice, I think it just can only deepen people's understanding and give us all a bit more insight into, like, a complicated, talented, incredibly, incredibly well-loved human being who I think we will be talking about for years. And I've just enjoyed this conversation so much. It's been a real treat for me. So thank you for taking the time to do it.
Matt, thank you. You asked great questions. I hope my answers were adequate. And again, congratulations on your Momentum Award. And you're doing great work. Thank you very much, bud.
Thank you so much. Bluegrass Jamalong is proud to be sponsored by Collings Guitars and Mandolins, making some of the finest guitars and mandolins in the world since the 1970s. Visit collingsguitars.com and find out why.